Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to one of our Urbanite Radio Conversations. And this is the keynote conversation that you can read in the September issue of the Urbanite. We are about to have a conversation with John Marsh, who is assistant professor of English at Penn State University. And he's been the author of books like Hog Butchers, Beggars, and Busboys, Poverty, Labor, and the Making, and a book called The Making of Modern American Poetry, and the editor of Your Work Tomorrow, an anthology of American labor poetry. His book that we're talking about is called Class Dismissed, Why We Cannot Teach or Learn Our Way Out of Inequality. And John Marsh, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show and to our Urbanite Radio discussions.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
I'm happy you're here, too. I tell you, this is we've done a lot of programs over the last 18 years in education. It's been big in our repertoire of productions and discussions. And yours is clearly kind of a contrarian attitude to what most of the establishment would think. One of the reviewers of your book had this quote, which I just want to read before we quote your book. And it was a quote from the West Wing that Aaron Sorkin wrote. And it was one of the characters who said, and I'll read the quote because I think it is on the opposite side of your spectrum.
Yeah.
Education is the silver bullet. Education is everything. We don't need little changes. We need gigantic, monumental changes. Schools should be palaces. The competition for the best teachers should be fierce. They should be making six-figure salaries. Schools should be incredibly expensive for government and absolutely free of charge to its citizens, just like national defense. And that is kind of the magic corporate foundation thinking of America's schools right now. That is
right.
That's the heart of it, really.
Absolutely right. Yeah.
But
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, but your thoughts are saying that maybe we're missing the boat. That education cannot be the be all end all of answering the questions for America's youth or our economy or equality.
Right. I should say that there is one part of that quote that I agree with, which is the six figure salary business for professors.
Nowhere
in the book do I argue against that, So I would take, as you rightly say, kind of the opposite stance to that, which is that just to put the sort of book in the sort of the largest frame. You know, there's this ongoing debate about how much teachers and schools can do to improve the educational performance of students, particularly low-income and minority students. And some, like Arne Duncan, who's the Secretary of Education, or you may have heard of Jeffrey Canada, who runs the Harlem Children's Zone. These reformers believe that schools can, you know, effectively perform miracles. They can take poor children from poor neighborhoods and from dysfunctional families, and they can make them college ready. Other critics, like Diane Ravitch and an educational scholar by the name of Richard Rothstein, argue that, in fact, you know, schools can't really affect the most important things that determine educational performance. And these are, you know, whether children grow up in poverty or whether they continue to live in poverty, that there are limits to schooling. I think the skeptics are right, but I think you also need to take a step back away from that debate because it might partly miss the point. And the way that I think about this is that, you know, if you just for the sake of argument, if you assume that the United States could do a much better job of educating low-income students and setting them on the path to college, it's not clear what all these new college graduates would do. The economy requires more workers with college degrees than ever before. You know, that's true, but for the foreseeable future, it's going to remain an economy that requires more workers without degrees than workers with degrees. And it's hard to see how an education will help workers trapped in these low-wage, non-union, no-degree jobs. And nor, very quickly for that matter, will it do much to reverse the growing economic inequality that's taken place in the United States. So the subtitle of the book, I guess, makes the point, which, you know, as you say, we cannot teach or learn our way out of inequality. I would add, too, that we can't teach or learn our way out of poverty, and the title, you know, makes the point as well, which is that if we do want to reduce poverty and inequality, we need to stop talking about classrooms and start talking about class, about economics, about who gets what and why, and how this might be different.
And therein lies the bogeyman beneath the subject.
Right.
Even the whole question of talking about class in America is something that we don't want to do. I mean, you quote in your book, late in your book, when you talk about the war on poverty, you have a really interesting discussion about that in terms of our consciousness about poverty in America and what it means. I thought that was pretty enlightening. Let me just find this part in the book here.
Sure.
You talk about when a writer who was an amazing writer back in his day before he passed on, Paul Jacobs, and Michael Harrington, who wrote The Other America, and
right.
Daniel Patrick Moynihan, were talking about the question of poverty in Ukraine. There's war on poverty under Lyndon Baines Johnson and his administration, that the focus had to be on jobs or the war on poverty with all its social programs, all its education programs, would not work.
Right.
I mean, and that was the centerpiece. Even if it didn't work, that was the centerpiece of what they understood.
Right. Yeah, so it can be kind of, I don't know, a little bit deflating to go back and realize that these debates that, you know, we're having now or that I'm trying to start now have been a part of American thinking about poverty and class for a long time. You mentioned Harrington and Jacobs and Moynihan, and there's at the time the U.S. Secretary of Labor understood these things as well. And you know, as the war on poverty, you know, was being planned, there was this kind of divide between people who wanted to focus on the kind of supply of workers. Was it going to be easier to create people for the job market, or was it going to be easier and better to create jobs for people already who may or may not take them? And this divide, it clearly kind of went towards those who were focusing on education policies. And there's this very kind of dramatic scene that a couple of the participants reconstruct later in kind of histories and oral histories of when they go to the Oval Office and you know, they present the plan to Lyndon Baines Johnson, and the U.S. Secretary of Labor says, you know, we really need this kind of jobs programs. This needs to be part of this war on poverty. And Johnson basically just kind of stonewalls the suggestion. And in that, you know, one moment, it turns out to be so determinative for what follows, in as much as, you know, for me at least, from that moment forward, debates about poverty in the United States and you know, to the degree that we would later then begin to debate inequality, they all begin to focus around education. And I think that's because of the influence of the war on poverty and the form that it took. But, you know, something had to be behind those people who were creating the war on poverty in the first place. But the thing that can be kind of deflating is that this attitude, this approach that we've had towards poverty has been around for a long time.
I'm going to go back to some of the things that you've been writing in the book, but also that you had in your column, which is a kind of a really condensed version of the book, really condensed, the piece you did for the Daily News in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the people you quote in there is Diane Ravitch, when she's
right.
talked about families are our children's most important educators. This woman who was an architect of No Child Left Behind, who has now turned on that completely. So I'm curious in what she says. I mean, are there, from all your research, effective ways that low-income families can be better educators, that low-income kids can be better educated, or is this just really just a notion we can't wrestle with in the way we do?
Yeah, so this gets a little bit strange, and it can seem... You know, when people argue that, it can seem kind of defeatist, or that it's you're selling kids short. You know, when people argue or say that, well, you know, educational achievement depends on family income, that can begin to seem like family background is destiny. You know, when we know that that's not true, there are all sorts of exceptions. And so, what people should say is, I think, you know, if you give me any fourth grader off the street and ask me to predict his income later in life, or whether he'll graduate from high school or college, the best prediction I would get, the best bet I would make, is merely by looking at how much money his family made. That does not mean that other factors don't play a part, you know, how hard the student works, how good his teachers or his schools are, but simply that family income is the best predictor. And one of the things that, you know, I think we've learned that's different from those earlier writers in the 60s and 70s who were having these same kind of debates is there are things that teachers can do. I don't deny the successes of some of the programs that Jeffrey Canada has started or is conducting. To the extent that we can get those to work, you know, we should support them with funds, with resources, with time, with personnel. But if we put all our eggs in that basket, I don't think, I might have to switch metaphors quickly, I'm not sure, I don't think that that's going to get us the results that we want. That if our goal is to fight poverty, yes, education can play a certain role. It's a diminished role. It's much less of a role than people want it to play or hope that it can play. But it's not going to be sufficient. I'd add, too, you know, that this works the other way, too. So, you know, if you improve a child's economic life, you also improve his educational life. I talked about Richard Rothstein earlier, the educational scholar and also economist. He likes to say that one of the greatest pieces of educational legislation in the last 30 years was the earned income tax credit, right? I mean, if you can move children out of poverty or move children out of sort of radical economic insecurity, you know, they can, they will succeed. And so I'm sympathetic to the concern that we're saying, well, family background determines everything. It doesn't determine everything, but it determines a lot. And on the one hand, you can say, well, that's defeatist. We just have to throw up our hands. On the other hand, you could say, well, how could we change family background? Could we affect it in ways that might enable students to do better in school?
And it does. I mean, when you it does fly in the face of the conversations you have with, like in Baltimore City here, Andres Alonso, who is the CEO of public schools here in Baltimore, or with the people who have been his mentors in New York, or the Arnie Duncan. They're all kind of on the same wavelength and page when it comes to education, which is, look, when we hear these conversations about poverty is a determining factor, class is a determining factor in how kids will do in school, and that this limits our children, that any child who comes out of poverty, he'll say, you know, I came out of a Cuban immigrant to New Jersey, and we five of us lived in two rooms, and we went out and worked, and I went to school, and they believed in education. I went off and got a law degree and a PhD, and, you know, now I'm there. Or one of our mayoral candidates here right now who's saying, I grew up in the housing projects. I was sexually abused as a child by my stepfather, but now I'm at MIT. I went to MIT, and now I'm running for mayor of Baltimore. You know,
right.
So, I mean, this is like, emotionally in America, given where we are, and given what the president was saying as well, this is a very tough discussion to have in the way you're trying to have it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it is difficult. And I think it's difficult because, I mean, people are telling these stories because people want to believe in them. And by the stories, I mean the stories of people getting ahead. I myself come from a working class background. A couple of times when I was a kid, we dipped below the poverty line. I can tell the same story about how it's education that led me to be where I am today. And it's an inspiring story, and people want to hear it. And they want to hear it, I think, because they don't much like the way the United States has developed in terms of income and inequality. And you can see this, you know, and this isn't just my hunch, that people have polled Americans, and they want to live in a more equal country. They want to do something about poverty. But they're, I would say, hampered by the same kind of logic that ruled the programs during the war on poverty, which is that Americans want a much more equal society. They want people to have a chance to get ahead, but they have a very firm belief in a just world. They want people to earn what they get. Right? And education allows that story. Education allows them to tell that story. People have worked hard in school. They've escaped poverty. These are the kinds of discussions about class and economic mobility that Americans want to have. But the problem is that, you know, that narrative, that story, simply can't be available for everyone. There are limits to the number of jobs that require college degrees. There's a wonderful quote by another economist that, you know, it's appropriate for every parent to hope that their child becomes a professional. It's not appropriate for the federal government to hope that every child becomes a professional. It's simply impossible, right? As a social policy, as a way of viewing the world, this simply will not work. So you're right, it's a difficult conversation to have because you can admire the impulse for people to want to share these stories and to be inspired by these stories. But at the same time, those kinds of stories may well be the very things that are inhibiting other avenues towards getting ahead that people may have had in the past or that they might have in the future. This sort of monomaniacal focus on education as the only path towards economic prosperity or security or out of poverty.
And what would those other avenues be? I mean, you know, you describe some in your book about what happened, how unimportant in many ways in the Horatio Alger myth of America that education was in up until the early part of the 20th century when there was a codification of professions where you had to go to college rather than be an apprentice, whether it was a doctor,
right,
lawyer, whatever that was.
Right.
So what would that be?
So I think that, and I should add, a number of economists share this belief that the reason the United States has grown so unequal over the last 30 years is because the average worker has lost bargaining power. And so if you wanted to reverse that trend, you would try to restore workers' bargaining power. And you can do that in any number of ways. Education does it to a very limited extent. You know, it gives people skills, gives skills to workers that those skills are in demand. Much lower unemployment rate would help. This increases demand for available workers, higher minimum wages. But traditionally, and I know this is not something that everyone likes to hear, but, you know, labor unions have often been the best way workers can increase their bargaining power. If we made it easier for workers to join unions, I think you would see a reduction in economic inequality, and you would see more paths out of poverty. I mean, so think of it this way. My father was a steelworker. He belonged to the United Steelworkers. He still does. So did his father, and his father, you know. If you go back and look at what working in the steel mills meant, say, at the turn of the century, you know, if you go back to, like, Homestead, Pennsylvania, and what it meant to work in the steel century, those were nasty, brutal, ill-paid jobs. And if you look at it after the 1930s, after the United Steelworkers came on the scene, you know, it became a middle-class job. So I like to think that I am where I am today, not just because I worked hard in school or got a good education, but because, you know, men like my father and grandfather formed unions and fought for decent jobs and middle-class lives. And without that, I seriously doubt that I would have been as successful in school. So it's kind of a more modest story that you can tell. People aren't going to necessarily fight their way out of poverty through education, but I think there's something, you know, ennobling and inspiring about past generations of workers who, you know, conducted an equally difficult fight out of poverty. They didn't do it through education. They did it through organizing, through collective action, things like this.
But just a personal question. I mean, do you have siblings?
I have a sister.
You have a sister. Did she go to college as well?
She did.
And so she's a professional?
She is.
So, I'm thinking about a lot of families I know who came out of the working class world, and a lot of their kids, not all, but a lot of kids of steelworkers ended up in college.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, that moved into that world. That was part of, if there was a Horatio Alger mythos, as you write about in your book,
mm-hmm,
that existed in the 18th and 19th and early part of the 20th century, that has been transferred to the middle part of the 20th century and 21st century as education.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I mean, I think so.
And that's what you talk about as well in your book. We've taken that, that's part of the subtext of your book, seems to me, is we've taken that mythological ideology of pull yourself by your bootstraps mm-hmm. to fit into the educational form model of this century.
Mm-hmm. I would make a distinction between, I guess, like, I don't think the sort of the joining a union is the same kind of bootstrap mentality or Horatio Alger story that existed in the 18th or 19th century. It was just, you know, first of all, those Horatio Alger stories are, you know, let's just say that if you were poor in the 19th century and you're reading Horatio Alger as a story about how to get ahead, it was not always the best advice. It would always involve these sorts of extraordinarily, you know, unlikely coincidences and turns of events. Usually Horatio Alger has to save the life of some wealthy guy who will then help him get ahead. It's not a fantastic program. But I mean, what I would, and I would distinguish that between, you know, and I recognize fully that, you know, when it comes to unions, I'm a bit of a romantic. I study them, you know, in my scholarly career, and I grew up in them. But all I mean to say is that education provides one path out of poverty and inequality. It's going to be a path that only, by definition, a few people can take. And by a few people, I don't mean, you know, two or three, but there are limits to the effects of this. That's to some extent true with unions, but not because there's limits to the number of people who can join unions. The old steel mill jobs used to be terrible jobs. Today's home health aide can be a terrible job, low paying, long hours, terrible working conditions. But there's nothing about these jobs that couldn't make them better. And to my mind, at least, you know, giving people that other possible alternatives for getting out of poverty or getting out of low incomes is only for the better, especially if there are limits to, you know, what education can do in this respect.
So if you can extend some of the stuff you're talking about before I come back to the heart of the book, I mean, do you think that in the United States of America now, it is impossible for children, especially children of color who are locked in poverty, to have a good education? Is that an impossibility?
Oh, but not at all. I mean, I think that you can. There's all sorts of evidence to show that's not true. I wouldn't want to suggest that at all. I mean, I'm a teacher. I'm an educator. I believe in these things completely. And you know, in the book, I talk about, you know, my inspiration for writing this book is
the Odyssey Project.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, and I started it basically on just those grounds, that education, and particularly higher education, was a social good, was something that we ought to offer to as many people as possible and give as many people as possible a chance to benefit from it. And I saw in my experience of directing that program, and I'll just say very quickly what it was. It's a humanities program for low-income adult students. So people who were living at about 150% of the poverty level or lower, and who were between ages 18 and 45, and we would have night classes taught by university faculty and sort of literature classes, philosophy classes, art history classes. Students would receive college credit for the courses. It was all free. They could transfer the college credit then to sort of local community colleges or to where I was at the time, University of Illinois. And I could see, I mean, there were people in those classes who, you know, up to that moment, the educational system had largely failed them, but who were brilliant students, who thrived in the course, with whom I've had some of the most, you know, meaningful conversations about literature that I've had in my, you know, career as a literature professor. And those are people who are, you know, 18 to 45, whose childhoods are over. So, you know, at a certain extent, I can still see and I can still believe in this transformative belief. But at the same time, I saw many people in that class failing who would drop out of the class either because they couldn't do the work, because they had a couple of jobs, because they had trouble lining up childcare, for any number of reasons that people have to deal with when they're living in poverty or on the edge of poverty. Life is extraordinarily complicated in those in that situation. And I began to think, well, yes, I have evidence that it's working for some people, but it's not working for everyone, and it can't work for everyone. So this can't, that is education, can't be the beginning and the end of the conversation. If it is, then we're really failing to imagine what social justice might look like or what economic justice might look like. For the people who failed in that class, for the people who couldn't complete the class, I mean, what other avenue towards economic security or out of poverty did they have besides education? And to me, that felt almost as disheartening as the successes did. And it's what led me to, you know, look into these questions. But I don't think that students can't succeed in education. I think that, I mean, that's an argument that I think got associated with Charles Murray and the bell curve and all this business, and that was
right.
You know, never, in no way. You know, I mean, the math behind it was shoddy. The sociology behind it was shoddy.
Yes.
We have, you know, an incredible amount of evidence to the contrary. So I don't think that in any way.
So where do you put in the scheme of analyzing where we are, and I am going to come back to the heart of your notion of what we have to do to end poverty and unions and what has to happen and the equality of certain nations in Europe and how they show a difference in the world. But when you look at the education reform movement in America today, Bill Gates and Arne Duncan and everyone else who are really pushing these ideas, and on the ground, as you spend in Chapter 2 time on the Harlem Children's Zone and Jeffrey Canada, I mean, are those models the right models in terms of educating our children? Is that the way we have to go? I mean, we're also, like, within that is this whole question of this notion of what we're teaching, which is teaching, you know, the things that you can test on these testing programs, which is not the kind of stuff that you teach. So, I mean,
right.
I wonder what your analysis of where all that fits into your analysis of education and poverty.
This probably goes slightly far afield of what I looked at in the book, but I'm always happy to speculate. I find a lot of when I read about Jeffrey Canada's work or the people associated with the KIPP programs, you know,
yes,
colleges,
right.
These sorts of charter school movements, you know, and in particular, you know, I'm an English professor, but I have sort of, you know, abiding love for data and statistics. You know, when you can show definitively that students, you know, who have certain teachers gain, you know, one or two standard deviations more in terms of their performance on tests than students who have other teachers, you know, that kind of success is hard to deny. So I think within the limited range of what they're imagining that they're doing, that these reforms will succeed, that they can nudge students to achieve more than they would have otherwise. That said, you know, I am sympathetic to critics. You know, we mentioned Diane Ravitch, who say that, you know, this is kind of warped education in the United States towards testing, so that basically, education becomes about reading and math, and what happens to social studies, what happens to history, what happens to, my field, literature, which is subsumed in reading, but the point isn't reading great literature, it's just sort of drill in these sort of basic reading things. So I'm sympathetic to the argument that these curricular reforms and these emphasis on testing is maybe leading education in directions that we don't want it to go. But, my point, I suppose, is this is a very small part of the conversation. Those are reforms about education, and they're masquerading as reforms about economics or about poverty or about inequality. When what I would want to suggest is that if you really truly care about poverty and inequality, if you want to reduce it on a large scale, if you want for it to be a kind of game changer, if you significantly want to affect poverty and inequality in the United States, forget about education. Forget about these kind of curricular reforms. Forget about even things that we would admire and say are working. They're working in what I would think of as a kind of really limited or narrow way.
And for most right now, that is not. It's a notion hard to get to and put your hands around, because we don't want to address. We don't want to really talk about the question of inequality. But I mean, everybody who writes an article talks about, as you do in your book, the growing income gap in America, the growing wealth gap in America. Articles out recently about the growing wealth gap, even between the black and white worlds, and both have dropped, have widened, I should say. But you used the word in the last commentary you just gave, which was masquerading.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we are. I mean, we're masquerading a war against poverty as, from your perspective, as the Horatio Alger myth and of picking yourself up by your own bootstraps and seeing that through the eyes of education and kids doing well. And I think no one's gotten, so that, you know, that's, and no one in any education system I've been looking at anywhere in urban America has got to the point where they can figure out how to do it.
Yeah, right. I mean, I would add just quickly, I mean, I think you can give more credit to education reformers than to say that they're part of the Horatio Alger myth. The Horatio Alger myth was that, this lone boy who was selling newspapers or shining shoes, through some combination of luck and industry and hard work and stick-to-itiveness, pulled himself out of poverty. But I think that education reformers would make a kind of, I think by and large these people, they're extraordinarily well-meaning. I mean, they don't want to leave poor people on their own. They don't want to abandon them.
Right.
They want to help
them.
My argument is just that, the ways they're going about trying to help, there are limits to them, and that the strategies they're adopting won't, in the end, accomplish what they want them to. But they're not. I mean, they're not horrible people.
No, not at all. At all.
I mean, the
people I've interviewed over the years in my involvement in education myself as a teacher and counselor and principal at different parts of my life is that people who run our school systems really do care about the kids. Andres Alonso loves children. He wants them to succeed. He has a pain in his heart when he looks at what happens to black and Latino kids in this country. I mean,
as well he should. Yeah.
Yes. And I think that's real. But I mean, but it becomes frustrating when you see the efforts to reform a school system and still the inability, for all the reasons of being mired in poverty, and if Diane Ravitch is right about it's in the home, that the frustration is there because nobody can pass the tests.
Right. Right.
Do you think that education, or that the way we approach education, can, for want of a better term, end this culture of poverty so children can learn? Or is the only way, from your perspective, that happens ultimately is if we end poverty?
Yeah. If you'd asked that question of maybe 40 years ago, when the sociologist named Christopher Jenks was writing a book.
That was my next question, was Jenks.
He would say, no. I mean, you're effectively wasting your time. I think that one of the things that Jeffrey Canada has shown, and one of the things that education reformers have shown, is that if you get there early enough, I mean, so for example, in the case of children whose vocabularies have separated by the time of age 3, I mean, imagine how much differential growth has taken place by the time they actually get into school. The children from poor families are starting at such a deficit against their peers that it's difficult to make up that time, to make up that distance. So I think that one of the greatest insights that Jeffrey Canada has had is that, you have to start basically from birth, from before birth, if you want to have any effect, if you want to equalize these things. But again, and, I'm very conscious of sounding like a broken record, but nevertheless, let's assume we could succeed at this, right? That you could catch children from poor families up with children from professional families. They can't all be professionals. This process has little or nothing to do with the structure of the American economy and what jobs are out there and what those jobs pay. So for as much as the conversation, you know, turns and returns to education, in the back of my mind, always, is to sort of ask, well, okay, what if? What if we could do these things? You know, what happens? All these debates about education are, you know, Jared Bernstein, kind of economist I respect a lot, they're debates about the supply side, if we can create these educated students, a job will sort of magically appear for them. But that is a kind of naive way, I think, of looking at the American labor market.
So, I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, the question then remains is that ultimately, on a mass level, we are not going to educate our way out of poverty, is one of your arguments.
Right.
And that the only way you can really achieve, and we'll talk about this in a minute, what education means, a real education for children, is if we battle poverty by fighting by unions, organizing and fighting for unions, and the unionization of workers to fight for a better living wage, to create a newer, more equitable society in America. That's part of your bottom line, right?
Absolutely. Right. And I suppose that, you know, I just think of it pragmatically. So we want to reduce poverty and economic inequality in the United States. Education is a shockingly indirect way to do that. Think of the number of things that have to go right, that have to work. First, we have to overcome all these achievement gaps. First, we have to overcome the differences in family background. Then we have to make sure that there's jobs for all the college graduates that we make. There's so many conditionals and, frankly, I think kind of implausibilities start to pile up that this doesn't become, to my mind, a terribly or at all effective way to go about ending poverty and economic inequality. I would think it'd be much easier, quite frankly, pay people more. We have since welfare reform in the United States, there are limits to how long you can be on welfare. So why welfare should continue to pay so little in an effort so that the people can kind of get themselves out of poverty, why we wouldn't pay them enough to lift them out of poverty, like if it's going to be on a temporary basis as the law stands now. These are the ways that you reduce poverty. And I would add that this would not make the United States some kind of outlier among developed countries. In fact, we're the outlier now in not doing these things. At the bottom of my argument is basically, you know, if you really want to reduce poverty and inequality, there are much simpler ways to go about doing it than education. The only reason we don't undertake those simpler and more direct ways is because we have some kind of lingering political or ideological objection to them. But I don't think that those political or ideological objections are compelling or compelling enough not to take these, you know, frankly, much more effective policies and put them to use.
We've been talking to John Marsh. Dr. John Marsh is the assistant professor of English, is an assistant professor of English at Penn State University. This is one of our Urbanite Radio stories, and we're talking about his book, Class Dismissed, Why We Cannot Teach or Learn Our Way Out of Inequality. And this is the keynote for the September Urbanite issue. And John Marsh, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com.